We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you back, Maria.
Thank you.
Yeah. Who'd you say you were again?
All right. Well, we missed you. I'm sure I know the audience.
I know at least one of you did.
Yeah. Oh, both of us, really.
Yeah. But, so.
And both of the audience members also.
So, very sad passing of someone we all know this week.
Yeah. Scott Morrow, who had been working on homelessness issues for really 40 years in Seattle, passed away this week of pancreatic cancer. He was 64. It was not widely known that he had been battling cancer, mostly among his circle of friends, which I'm proud to say I was one. That was how he lived his life. He liked being behind the scenes. He didn't like drawing attention to himself, but he did anyway because he was an unrelenting advocate for the unhoused. And that in Seattle will earn you a lot of enemies, whose enmity, Scott pretty much wore as a badge of honor. He was very principled and he was very, very stubborn. And, those things will take you a long way. All of the tent cities, Tent City 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then, Nicholsville and tiny houses and all the different things that have grown out of that, those were Scott's doing. And he didn't get credit for it because he didn't like to get credit for it. He accomplished a tremendous amount and, really, one of the best community organizers I've ever seen. And he has had the unrelenting hostility of, folks in power in Seattle for 40 years as well, because he insisted on, homeless encampments being self-managed. The homeless themselves having, agency in how they're treated and what kind of institutions they can organize. It's a radical concept. Certainly in Seattle, where paternalism has ruled for 40 years. And, he insisted on it.
It's still a concept that rubs a lot of people wrong, even, people in the city government who have had to admit that the tiny house village concept has been very helpful in getting people off of the street, stabilized and into permanent housing. That self-governing model gives people a sense of confidence, and it gives them a feeling that yes, they can manage their lives again. Something that you lose when you're on the street.
And I have to say that, Scott also earned the enmity of people in the service provider community who wanted to suck up to people in power. And you're seeing that in some of the social media remembrances, and you're seeing that in the lack of obituaries in mainstream media in Seattle. The Seattle Times is not mentioned as passing. The Stranger is not mentioned as passing. It's weird, honestly. Because he was a force for so long and, frankly was a lightning rod for a lot of criticism. Because people who don't like the homeless generally didn't like Scott Morrow. But he accomplished a tremendous amount just by being principled and being uncompromising and being keeping at it, He was keeping at it even when he was seriously ill a few weeks ago. He'll be tremendously missed, and I'm very sad at his passing. He was a friend.
All right. Well, shifting gears, starting with local, Mike Kreidler making the news this week.
Yeah, Mike Kreidler is the insurance commissioner of the state. He's been in that elected position since the year 2000. He's 78 years old. And this week, news broke that he was being investigated by the state for a number of racist comments and for tweeting his staff, particularly staff members who were of color. The Insurance Commissioner's Office has some 240 staff members. It's a big office. And there had been a lot of complaints that he treated non-white staff members differently, and that he used pejorative terms that shouldn't be used on the radio or anywhere else. It really underscores that he has not changed with the times in terms of, you know, recognizing social norms have changed, put it that way. And, it was not surprising. I mean, Kreiler has done a lot of good things in that office. He has really kept the private insurance, health insurance industry, more or less in line. And he, you know, every 4 years, every election cycle, he faces a Republican candidate who's bankrolled by the insurance commissioning because, insurance industry, because they hate Kreiler. And every 4 years he would win handily, because it was obvious that his opponents had really no agenda other than giving the private insurance industry everything they want, which is not a popular thing.
Not here in Washington State, anyway.
Yeah, because everybody has had personal experience mm-hmm. with how predatory health insurance companies can be. And how they really are inserted in the American healthcare system between the consumer and healthcare, and are making healthcare decisions based on, you know, company profitability as opposed to, the wellness of the customer. So Kreiler has been a force for good, but he is in hot water now. I would be surprised if he ran for re-election in 24, but first he has to survive this scandal, and it's very unfortunate to see.
Well, it may be that Governor Inslee may have to appoint someone younger in the Democratic Party to replace him.
Yes.
At a certain point, he is 78 years old. Sometimes you see with folks who are getting close to 80 that they are having cognitive issues, and sometimes you see this as part of that, particularly among elderly white people, I should say. And I'm not saying that that's what it actually is, but that could be what it is.
Yeah, well, this apparently is a pattern that has gone on for years.
For years, okay.
Reported. There's been a very high turnover in recent years in Kreiler's office, especially among his senior staff.
Yeah, and sometimes as folks get older, particularly as they get very elderly, they become more vocal in their prejudices if they have them already. So
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that can make them extremely hard to work with, not just for people of color, but for people who find that kind of an attitude absolutely odious.
Yes.
All right. Moving on. Not a household name, but Jordan Peterson apparently is coming to town in May.
Yes, he is a household name among people on the far right. Of which there are some in the Seattle area, and he's coming to do a shindig at the Paramount Theater, and a lot of community activists are now pressuring the Paramount and Live Nation, which is actually renting out the Paramount for the night and putting him on to cancel his appearance. He is a Canadian psychologist. And very vocal Trump supporter who has been spreading COVID misinformation for the last couple of years and has been jumping on the anti-gay far-right bandwagon more recently.
Speaking of odious.
Yes, he characterizes, same-sex couples as a what's the term for it? He basically thinks it's a psychological illness, which is a
which puts him in a questionable minority within the psychological community these days.
Well, yeah, not if you're in 1950, but
yeah, definitely, exactly.
Definitely if you're in 2022. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing a lot of activists from the gay community and other activists, allies, saying this guy shouldn't have a platform like that in Seattle. He is not welcome here. It is scheduled, I believe, for May 3rd, so it's coming up in the next week or two. But expect to see a lot more attention being paid to him as that date gets nearer.
Well, and, you know, with the weather warming up, you know, protests are just a natural thing to progress to. You know,
it's true. And, you know, Paramount is right down the hill from an awful lot of gay clubs, just saying.
Yeah.
But, I mean, those kind of attitudes have a long history of leading to violence against the gay community in Seattle. So, it really isn't funny. Yeah. You know, literal bombing of some of those gay clubs going back, you know, 20 years. So, yeah, it's he really is out of step with how the vast majority of people in Seattle see the world.
Moving on, this week's police accountability news, which there's a lot of.
Yeah, there is.
There is quite a bit, yeah. This week, the Office of Inspector General of the Seattle Police Department released a report that said that the Office of Police Accountability, which is tasked with overseeing complaints and investigating complaints against police officers in Seattle, the OPA has refused to investigate any of the complaints made against officers for not wearing masks during the pandemic, including an incident in which an officer refused to wear a mask inside of Harborview Medical Center. That officer.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that officer, Eric Whitehead, was given a one-day suspension by the Seattle Police Department, but the OPA was not involved in that decision, and they did not investigate it. The OPA calls issues of mask noncompliance a, quote, cultural problem, end quote, and a systemic issue that the OPA is not required to investigate, but that the Seattle Police Department needs to fix by itself. All right. But then the report went on, the OIG's report. It said that the SPD rarely disciplines officers for any mask violations, including multiple violations by the same officer. The State Department of Labor and Industries, in fact, has penalized the Seattle Police Department twice for violations of the mask mandate, yet the department has never seriously addressed the issue. And Andrew Meyerberg, the former head of the OPA, said months back that no one at police headquarters wore masks and that it would be unfair to penalize officers on the street for following the example of their supervisors. So then you have to ask, okay, who then is policing the supervisors? And the answer, of course, is nobody, not even the current interim chief, Adrian Diaz. Right. And that's exactly what's wrong with our police reform process. Essentially, the cops do what they want and they can get away with having a quote unquote culture of noncompliance. Right. So this report was really kind of a proof that that's exactly what's going on at the Seattle Police Department. Now, this week, City Attorney Ann Davison's office announced that she would be dismissing about 2,000 misdemeanor cases, including cases involving property destruction, theft, criminal trespass, and non-DUI traffic violations. This comes after Davison won her election last fall by saying that she would aggressively prosecute misdemeanors. Now, these 2,000 cases make up just short of half of the backlog of unfiled cases at the city attorney's office. A spokesperson for her office said this week, quote, simply filing every case would not resolve the backlog. The court system cannot handle an influx of cases of this magnitude all at once, end quote. No kidding, right? And you can argue too that the courts will not be able to handle a continuing flood of these low level cases, which is exactly what Davison had proposed to do on the campaign trail, is to file all misdemeanor cases and send them to the courts, right? So there's a reason now she's finding that that Pete Holmes didn't do that. I guess reality is different from the fantasy world of Republican policy and the sort of tough on crime rhetoric that, you know, we prosecute every crime, et cetera. Well, no. And then finally.
So go ahead. I imagine there must be some real outcry coming from all the people that were questioning Antike's or her opponent's.
Nicole Thomas Kennedy. Yeah.
Her opponent's stance on this whole thing. They were just saying that it was going to be utter chaos.
I know.
Someone yep. got in office that did that.
Heaven forbid. Yeah. And
heaven forbid. Yes.
And lo and behold, she was right.
Heaven forbid it is utter chaos. No. No, it's not utter chaos. It's business as usual, which is a little surprising, but I guess I'm not really surprised that when confronted with reality, Davison is having to do exactly what the Holmes city attorney's office did.
Yeah, and both of her opponents in the primary, Holmes and Thomas Kennedy, advocated.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, this week also, the Seattle Human Rights Commission, one of several independent commissions funded by the city, which includes like the Women's Commission, et cetera, the Seattle Human Rights Commission is attempting to gain amicus status on the consent decree, on the police reform consent decree. In other words, they want friend of the court status, which would allow them to petition the court, document police misconduct, and or file a brief in support of or against the city regarding various aspects of the police accountability process. Now, the Community Police Commission is the official body under the consent decree that's supposed to represent the public in this process. But there is clearly now a divide within communities of color, perhaps a generational divide here, in which the younger folks on the Seattle Human Rights Commission feel that the Community Police Commission is not stepping up to the plate. Okay. A recent report by the...
And that criticism has come up in several other facets in recent months.
It has. Yeah. Now, a recent report by the court-appointed police monitor, which I know Job talked about last week, shows that the Seattle Police Department is still using force disproportionately against people of color. Which should lead many people to ask, hey, why after a decade of the police reform process are we still seeing this huge disparity? Okay. And one answer may be that the current reform process is toothless, right? And the CPC, unfortunately, is part of that process.
And is viewed as
part of that process by a lot of younger members of the community.
And I would also say that there is an institutional rot within SPD that has not been addressed by the reform process. That literally you would have to fire almost all current SPD officers in order to...
I don't know that you would have to fire all officers. You might have to fire all the management.
Yeah, but the point is that those kind of attitudes have been allowed to fester within SPD for decades, and it has not been seriously addressed. That cultural rot within SPD has not been seriously addressed by the reform process. You know, you are not going to go to a diversity training for a week and come away with a different attitude. It just doesn't work. And it clearly hasn't worked with
SPD. And you're not going to get an email from your chief saying, hey guys, try to wear a mask whenever you can. And that's going to change the culture. It's not, you know, especially when you come back to the precinct and nobody's wearing a mask, including your superiors.
And half of the people who aren't wearing a mask when they're asked are going to say, because, well, COVID-19 is a hoax. I mean, you know,
exactly.
And literally you were getting, officers saying things like that the last couple of years. It really is bad within SPD. And, I'm sure there are officers who do great jobs and all the rest of it, but they are in the minority. Mm-hmm. In terms, especially in terms of how they treat communities of color.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any more on?
Nope, that's the police accountability news for this week.
All right,
I'm sure there'll be more next week.
I had one additional item on that, uh-huh. which is that Crosscut had a great article this week on prosecutors across the state of Washington regularly compromising defendants' due process rights by not sharing information that could be exculpatory. In other words, they're required under law to give defense counsel information that investigations come across that might exonerate the defendants. And they almost never do that, and they face almost no consequences for doing that. It's a great article. It's in Crosscut, and I recommend people read it.
It's actually Melissa Santos's last article working at Crosscut before she moves over to Axios.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, so there's a thing called a Brady list for police officers that they can get to join the list if they have been found by their peers and the criminal justice system to have basically lied or misrepresented
right.
things in the past. So there's this running list,
especially in court.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the. But apparently there's not really a list for prosecutors who have withheld and or manipulated stuff in court. So
no, and the public almost never finds out about it.
Yeah.
So which also gets to the lack of local reporting in so many parts of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So when talking about defunding the police and reforming and or, you know, fixing our criminal justice system, that's one of the many items that people on the inside are fully cognizant of and are, you know, pushing for change. But it doesn't tend to come up much in the public debate about fixing our criminal justice system, the role that prosecutors play mm-hmm. in being so key in continuing to leave the word justice out of the whole
out of the equation. Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, all right. Hey, moving on. Mm-hmm. Looking at my list here, city council.
Got an update this week on the city's economy and our potential tax revenue this year to fund the city government. It was pretty good news. Yeah, sorta. So that's why I'm going to talk about it. The City Council's Finance and Housing Committee met this week. That's chaired by Teresa Mosqueda. They're the committee that tackles the budget. They got an update this week from the new Office of Economic and Revenue Forecasts. That's the office that was created by the City Council last year to give it a more independent look at the local economy and the city tax revenue sources outside of what they get from the City Budget Office, which the City Council, at least Mosqueda and the majority of the City Council, felt that the City Budget Office was influenced too heavily by the mayor, the last mayor. and they didn't like some of the estimates they got from the city budget and how far off they were from reality. So they created this new Office of Economic and Revenue Forecasts to give them a more, what they thought would be a more accurate look at how the local economy was doing and how much tax revenue the city could expect in the current year. Now, this April report included a projection of how well the city's economy is doing. And it also looked at the sales tax, the B&O tax, the new jumpstart payroll tax, and the real estate excise tax. So four big contributors to the city's budget. Now, the centerpiece of their estimate of the economy, they kind of have to look globally, nationally, and then at the local economic outlook to give us an idea of how the local economy is doing, was that rising prices, particularly for food, energy, and housing, but also for construction materials, and disruptions in the supply chain because of COVID-19 and the war in Ukraine were the big things that were impacting the economy globally and nationally. Nevertheless, our local economy looks really good with 1.8 job openings available per each officially unemployed person. And I say officially unemployed because there are many people who are unemployed who are not being counted by the official statistics of unemployment. But they also show wage gains for the average Seattleite of about 12 to 15% since February 2020. So in other words, it's a workers' market. However, there are still some depressed sectors of the economy, especially the hospitality industry, which is still down about one-third from its 2019 level. So the hospitality industry isn't just, say, sports games. It's also, you know, restaurants, it's hotels, it's concert halls, it's playhouses, it's the whole arts and entertainment industry.
And they were struggling with labor issues prior to the pandemic.
Yeah, and partly because it's hard for people working minimum wage to live in Seattle right now with the high housing costs. And so finding workers to staff restaurants and other places like hotels, for example, other places that rely on lower wage workers was really hard, which means that, of course, they have to raise their wages, right? In order to do that. And so we've seen wage gains of about 12 to 15%. But of course, inflation takes a bite out of those, right? Now, manufacturing is also lagging. Even though you would think that disruptions in the supply chain should prompt an increase in domestic manufacturing, right? When you can't get your goods from China anymore in a timely manner, maybe local businesses can start making those things. But there's such a large chunk of money in our economy here in the United States, but globally, I think there's such a large chunk of money tied up at the top levels of our economy that's just kind of sitting there unproductive and inefficient and not being used to start new businesses. And by that, I mean the rich have too much wealth, right? And it's stagnating in their hands and in their accounts.
Yeah, you can only buy so many yachts. I mean, the limit's about three. Right.
Yeah, you can buy and house all the sports cars you want, but that's not productive. You know, so there's way too much wealth in the hands of too few people for it to be, and it doesn't circulate through the economy, creating new businesses where they're needed. So there are these disruptions in the supply chain. Manufacturing is lagging, and that is something that's holding back our economy. Now, notably, housing prices in the Seattle area increased 20% over the past 12 months. So you'll notice I talked about wage gains of 12 to 15% over the last 2 years, but over the past 1 year, housing has increased 20%. So there you go. I mean, you can see a big jump in your pay, but more than that's now going to pay your rent or your mortgage, right? That almost matches, and I have to say that almost matches the 24% rent increase that I got this year, this past December. And this is going to massively complicate the effort to house people, homeless people, and to build more affordable housing, I have to say. So that means there's going to be more pressure on the city, on city government to make changes in land use policy, particularly in where multifamily housing can be sited in the city of Seattle. And that has to happen ASAP, I think, in order to make housing more affordable here in Seattle, but also for reasons of climate change. So we can't have people driving as much as they have been.
And we've known that for at least a decade.
Yeah, we've known that for a while now. As for the city's tax revenue, it's still pretty early in the year, but 2021's jumpstart payroll tax collections were 25% higher than forecasted. So last year, about a quarter more than they expected. So the city collected about $248 million versus just under the $200 million that they expected. That's a nice chunk of change, and that the city could see a jump in that again. Now, job growth in the information and professional and business services category seems to indicate that the city will have higher B&O tax collections too, given that those two sectors make up about 82% of the city's business tax base. So big job growth has been happening in those sectors, and those sectors are what usually account for the bulk of the B&O tax revenue. So that could be much higher as well. Now, the sales tax, which is a big chunk of the city's income, could be negatively impacted by the slow recovery of the hospitality industry, which usually accounts for a pretty significant chunk of the sales tax. The real estate excise tax is based on real estate sales volume plus the value of the properties that are sold. While values are rising, we saw that big jump, 20% jump over the past year, interest rates are also rising. And, you know, that's inflation, right? Interest rates rise with inflation. And that could put a damper on the number of home sales. But if the job market remains hot, as it has been, Seattle could continue to attract a lot of new residents. And that's really a big driver of the local housing market. So all told, the forecast is that the city will probably collect about $90 million more than forecast last year when the budget was passed. Okay, so that's what the new office is saying. Now, this week in the same meeting, the Finance and Housing Committee also heard a similar presentation by the City Budget Office, so they could kind of compare notes, right? The CBO filled in some of the gaps in the Office of Economic Revenue Forecasts report by looking at the city's other sources of income, including property taxes, public utility taxes, license and permit fees, parking fees, court fines, federal and state grants, the short-term rental tax, the sweetened beverage tax, vehicle license fees, and a host of smaller fees and taxes. Now, many of these fees and taxes are dependent upon city businesses reopening and people going back to work and people going to sports games, movies, concerts, and restaurants, essentially the hospitality sector, which, as we've seen, has been slow to recover. The CBO's forecast is that these sources of revenue will be about $4 million less than budgeted last year. Their forecast of all city tax revenue, including the revenue sources that we've already discussed, like the sales tax, the B&O tax, and the B&O tax, shows a likely $70 million increase over last year's forecast. So there's not a huge difference between $70 million and $90 million, right? But again, this is only the revenue side of the city budget. The expense side will also be different from what was initially budgeted and probably higher because of inflation. And the CBO was quick to point out that last year's budget included a couple of one-time sources of revenue, in particular the Mercer Megablock sales proceeds and federal COVID-19 funds, so that the $70 million surplus that they projected may not be an actual surplus that the city council will be able to spend. It may just plug holes that we know will exist already in the 2023 budget because of those one-time revenue sources that we won't have in the future. So the City Budget Office is expected to give another presentation, this time on the full budget, both the expense and the revenue side, to the committee on May 4th. So we'll see what they have to say about that. And it'll be interesting to see how the city council members respond to it as well.
Yeah.
You know, when you were talking about the home sales and the impact of whether local economy can keep up with that, you have to think that a significant portion of that of home sales is going to be consumed by foreign limited
investment.
Yeah,
Yeah.
As, cause that's been the pattern so far, and it looks like that's just been increasing, and it doesn't seem to be like, you know, a major concern amongst.
Let's talk for a second about the reason for that. It's not just, foreign investors seeing a hot market in Seattle and thinking, wow, if I jump in there and grab property, it'll appreciate because it's been appreciating like crazy. It's also this view that if you buy property, it's a sure thing. It's kind of like as you get older and you want to make sure that your investments are less volatile as you age, that they won't be as subject to market swings. You move from stocks, you move a significant chunk of your money from stocks to bonds or to cash because that's a sure thing. It's not going to lose its value if the market swings. A lot of people view real estate in that light because even if the economy collapses or if there's a major depression, you still have this asset that is desirable and that will regain its value eventually or hold its value.
Another major factor, this started about a decade ago, but it's only been continuing, is the outflow of foreign real estate investment from British Columbia, where they imposed a tax on on foreign investment in real estate because it was driving up real estate prices in Vancouver radically.
Double digits every year like it is here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Vancouver has been facing the same problem, and leaders in BC tried to address this. Meanwhile, political leaders in Washington state have just looked the other way. They're just fine with exploiting real estate costs.
Yeah. And see, the point I was trying to get at is that the reason why you're seeing so much foreign investment and properties being bought for investment is because you have all these, you have a certain number of people with too much money, you know, way more money than they need to live on. And they, because of the volatility of things like climate change and the volatility of the markets and things like the war in Ukraine, but also a lot of uncertainty about the future and about the future of financial markets under impending climate change and climate disasters, you see them looking for a safer place to park their money. And for a lot of them, in order to get their money into something really, really safe, they're looking for real estate. They're looking to buy land. And, Seattle's a hot market. And
yeah.
A lot. And Jav really, said,
and the entire
really,
West Coast is actually.
Yeah. And as Jav was saying, there's really the government places, our local government is placing no restrictions on who can buy property, where and how much and how they use it. So it makes it a perfect place for foreign investors to park their money. And it's a very safe place for them to do so. So I think it would be a good idea to look at raising the real estate excise tax, particularly on foreign investors. But there's been this big pushback, but of course, by real estate companies and construction companies saying, oh no, that's racist. You know, if you place a tax on anyone who doesn't live within the city of Seattle coming in and buying property, that's racist. It also could pose a barrier for the job, for people who are relocating here to take advantage of our hot job market. So there are many ways, there are many things that complicate that.
Yeah.
So it would definitely be worth looking at what BC, what British Columbia did in order, and Vancouver did in when they put their tax into place and say, hey, you know, how could we adapt that here? I don't think that that's actually been done.
No, I don't think it's on anybody's radar, honestly.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that I've heard.
Yeah. All right. Okay. And let's see, finally, we got King County Metro dropping their mask.
Yeah, just as COVID-19 cases are ticking upwards again, they went up about 17% countywide this week with almost 600 new cases per day. But Metro Transit has dropped the requirement that riders must wear a mask. And this is at the same time that King County Health Officer Dr. Jeff Duchan said this week, quote, "We recommend wearing a high-quality, well-fitting mask in crowded indoor public spaces, including on metro buses and other public transit, such as ride shares," end quote. And studies have shown that buses and inner-city trains, like our light rail lines, are the riskiest places to be without a mask when you're traveling. So, of course, the King County Metro is saying, well, they have to drop it because U.S. District Court Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell in Florida overturned the national mask mandate on airplanes, trains, and buses.
But yes, that ruling is being appealed. She's a Trump appointee, and it was widely seen as being ideologically driven, the actual ruling.
Yeah.
And so you're getting this really mixed reaction among transit systems around the country, systems in LA, San Francisco, New York, Chicago are keeping their mask mandates.
Yeah.
But you've got other, transit systems in places like Philadelphia, Boston, Atlanta, DC and here in Seattle that are dropping their mask mandates, which I think is incredibly short-sighted, particularly because the subvariant of Omicron, BA2, has gotten a strong foothold around the country, including here in Seattle. And as you say, new case rates have gone from roughly 150 a day a month ago to 600 a day now. They've quadrupled in a month. So, take that under advisement. I would say continue to wear a mask if you're going to use public transit.
Absolutely. I recommend it.
Incidentally, ride shares like Uber and Lyft have dropped their mask mandates as well.
Yes, so I would absolutely wear a mask in a rideshare situation.
Yeah. Cabs have dropped their mask mandates, like Yellow Cab. I would not take that as your cue to throw away your mask, as a lot of people are doing. Keep taking precautions, because we are still in the middle of a pandemic. And no matter how much business leaders and the politicians they own are trying to convince us that the pandemic is in the rearview mirror, it's all of a thing of the past, we can go out and party now like it's 2019 or 1999. It's just not. We are still at risk. We're still seeing a number of deaths per day locally from COVID-19. It's not a benign form of it yet. Even though the subvariant like Omicron itself is a little bit milder, particularly for people who've been vaccinated, than the original virus was, but it can still be deadly. Most deaths, but not all, are coming among people who are not vaccinated. So get your vaccine. If you've had a booster, get a second booster. You're probably eligible for it now. Most people are. So, And there's plenty of vaccine out there. It's not like the early days where you had to schedule out. You can pretty much walk into a drugstore and get one. So please do it, because you're protecting yourself, you're protecting your community, you're protecting your family. It's just mind-boggling how obtuse not only the reaction on the right has been to the pandemic, but the reaction in the court system, the reaction among legislators, the reaction among regulatory agencies. It's been very discouraging as somebody who, in a previous life taught, community medicine and public health, that the public health experts on this have widely been ignored. And they're sitting here going, oh my God, this is a disaster. This is going to make things far worse. And they're right. But nobody's listening.
Yeah, and you probably want to save your mask anyway, because we're about to start fire season here on the West Coast.
Yes.
Pretty much, if you haven't ordered those in bulk, you know, for the rest of your life, you might want to put that one on the calendar.
Yeah. A gas mask and an oxygen cylinder might be a good idea at this point. To have an independent supply of air. Welcome to the new normal.
Mm-hmm.
Not 100% what we presented on the brochure, but you know.
Yeah. We took our cue from the real estate industry. We photoshopped a different future into the brochure, put it that way.
So we kind of segued there into a full-blown pandemic update. Anything else you wanted to add to that?
That was pretty much the major news this week. Locally, cases are still going up, as Maria said. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nationally, the ruling by the judge in Florida really threw transportation policy for a loop this week. In Philadelphia, they adapted an indoor mask mandate on Monday because of rising cases, and then they promptly dropped it yesterday. Why did they do that? Because both adopting the mandate and dropping it were automatically done through state policy as a trigger by rising cases. Rising cases started subsiding, they immediately dropped it. Which, you know, that's kind of a prescription for cases rising again. But, and it is a prescription for people getting more and more cynical and just disregarding, you know, official, mandates and just not complying with them. Because, you know, they see these capricious seeming, changes, you know, from week to week. It's maddening for a lot of people. People are at this point in the pandemic after, more than 2 years in, are just getting really cynical about, those kind of pronouncements because they've changed so often and the messaging around them has been so muddled.
Plus I think there's a lot of, mask and pandemic fatigue. People just are like, well, I'm at the point now where if I get it, I get it, and then I'll be done. You know?
Yeah.
So they're just tired of it.
I already got it, so I'm done. So,
But, you know, even among the people in my workplace, I'm seeing people get it and whole households get it. You know, nobody getting seriously ill. But let me tell you, even with the milder variants, you can still get long COVID, and long COVID can disable you long term for months, if not years.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, moving along. Joe Biden visited Seattle yesterday, but he was also doing a dog and pony show with some signings this week.
For Earth Day, yes.
He did. Well, the Biden administration this week announced that they were restoring part of the National Environmental Policy Act that was removed by Donald Trump. That's the rule that requires an analysis of the greenhouse gas emissions of a proposed project and how climate change would affect any new infrastructure that's being built. And that rule also gives local communities a greater say in whether those projects can move forward. So it means that local governments have to look at the impact of, say, a major freeway on a local community before they build it. And they have to give the community some kind of say as to whether they want that freeway to split their neighborhood. Right.
So why wasn't this done 15 months ago? That's my question.
That's a good question.
That should have been a no-brainer on, like, you know, like the first week in office.
I know.
As with many of the Trump era policies, and instead, he saved it as a special gift for Seattle.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, I should point out too, this week the Interior Department announced it would sell more oil and gas drilling leases on public lands and waters. this comes in spite of Joe Biden's campaign promise that he would end that practice entirely.
And that practice was not done until the Trump administration. That again was a relevant administration.
I don't.
Biden
I don't know about that. I think that's been a feature of most past administrations to a certain extent, that there have been some guardrails put around it, but the Trump administration kind of kicked those guardrails into the drink. And now the Biden administration is saying, oh, yeah, we're going to do it too. But it's a response to rising oil and gas prices, which, you know, I find it discouraging that the response to inflation, energy cost inflation is, oh, drill, baby, drill. You know, oh, we need to, you know, release all of these barrels of oil from the national stores, you know, and I just feel like, God, no. I mean, this is an opportunity for people to get off of oil and gas, right? Mm-hmm. The federal government and state governments and local governments should be providing more incentives for people to get off of oil and burning oil and gas as much as quickly as possible.
And it's not like 10 years ago when electric vehicles were a novelty. I mean, Elon Musk is the richest man in the world because he leaped into that market. Most major car manufacturers, even American car manufacturers, have electric vehicles in almost all their lines right now. It's becoming mainstream. You're seeing many more of them on the road in Seattle.
And it's not only that. I mean, it's also policies that would allow people to move out of the suburbs and into the inner cities and be able to afford the housing prices, right? Things like looking at land use policy and allowing more multifamily housing to be built in more places within the city of Seattle and other cities. It's things like looking at where you're providing public transit and how frequent it is and how reliable it is. It's things like how do you build not just inner city rail, but regional rail that allows people to get from one city to another or visit their family in other parts of the world without having to rent a car or drive their car. You know, it's all these different things. And really, you know, the Joe Biden's administration is basically saying, well, we have a bill that would do a whole bunch of that stuff, but it's stuck in Congress because of these two senators. Well, okay, that did, you know, what do you do when you can't get past that barrier? You start looking at executive orders, right?
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, which Obama was very good at using.
Yeah.
And Biden was certainly in the front seat row for that.
You start organizing with the states and saying what can be done on a state and regional level, right? If it can't be done at the federal government. You know, you start looking at things that would benefit both Republicans and Democrats, like modernizing the electrical grid. You know, I mean, there are plenty of Republican states where that's also an issue and where you could get Republicans on board with that. You know, there's many, many things that the Biden administration could be doing that they're not doing. Instead, they're doing these horrible things, which is let's dig up more of our carbon reserves. Let's dig up more oil and gas. Let's spew more carbon into the air. You know, climate change, that's the next generation's problem.
Yeah. And meanwhile, let's take a dog and pony show on the road.
Yeah. And let's sign a bill to, you know, help forests. Well, you know, in a state where we do more to help forests than just about anywhere else in the nation, you know, that's great. But it wasn't, it was such a non-event that it barely made the national news.
Yeah.
Right.
It really didn't, honestly.
Didn't really. I know. I was just looking for it today. It's like, oh, nobody covered it because it was a non-event, essentially.
Yep.
And Joe Biden came to Seattle. What did he do? Did he have a rally? Did he meet with environmental groups? Did he meet with young people and students? Did he hear what people were saying and what their concerns were? No, he went and rubbed elbows with rich tech guys in on Mercer Island and the East Side to
raise
money for the midterms. That's what he did.
If you wanted to spend $50,000 for a crappy dinner, then to rub elbows with him, then he could hear what your concerns were. Most people don't have that kind of money to throw around.
Yeah.
And so people who are not representative.
So when you hear talk in the mainstream press about how the Democratic Party is sliding and that, you know, they're going to lose the midterms in the Senate and all this kind of stuff, keep in mind who, you know, the Democratic Party is and what their policies have been. It's been to have an open door to rich tech billionaires, right? And kick the door closed when, you know, an average person wants to go there and talk about, hey, how come you're not expanding transit? Yeah. Okay. You know, how come you're not doing the real work to, you know, deal with climate change right now?
Yeah. And, their concern about so-called kitchen table issues pretty much comes down to, you know, using focus groups to determine how to lie about what they're doing.
Yeah.
More palatably.
Yeah. And then to make the excuse, well, you know, a court ruling means that we have to allow more, you know, we have to administratively allow oil and gas companies to come and apply for leases on public land. It's like, no, that's not true.
If it were a high priority, you'd be seeing a very different public facing policy.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we've just got a few minutes left. How about an update on Ukraine?
The war is still going in Ukraine, unfortunately. Russia is making gains in the east where they're concentrating their forces. Those are the breakaway provinces around the Donbas region that Russia recognized as independent republics. They're trying to connect that with their holdings on the southern coast. The city of Mariupol is squarely between those two areas and the Crimean Peninsula. And there really isn't much city of Mariupol left. The city really has been destroyed, and it's going to go down in history as one of the great war crimes. And we're seeing that in real time. And we're seeing the diplomatic effort against Russia by the United States and NATO countries. It's really boiling down to throwing more arms into the conflict on the side of Ukraine. Ukraine has more than held its own. They're getting overwhelmed at this point, I think, particularly in the cities and in areas in the east where the shelling has been incredibly heavy. The destruction has been enormous. The Russian attitude seems to be that, you know, we want to destroy, the capacity for there to be a Ukrainian nation. And that includes, driving Ukrainian people into exile or just, you know, mass murdering them. We're seeing satellite evidence of graves, mass graves in Mariupol. Nobody can get into Mariupol because it's been under siege for over a month now. But people who've managed to get out are telling absolute horror stories. And you're hearing this over and over across the country of Ukraine by people who have survived Russian occupation in different cities and towns. Just saying that it's been mass slaughter. That's starting to get out of the headlines because the mainstream media has a short attention span. But we're really witnessing war crimes on a scale that we have not seen since World War II. With things like Dresden and Tokyo and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the concentration camps. It's that level of ethnic cleansing. Really, really frightening, and you would have to think the world is not powerless to intervene. But so far the response continues to be limited because people are afraid of triggering nuclear war with Russia. But at some point, there's going to have to be a stronger response because people are dying in real time.